Well, good morning and welcome to Green Zine here at Royalton Community Radio, WFVR-LP, South Royalton, serving the communities of the Upper White River Watershed at a full 100 watts of low power FM on the dial at 96.5 and streaming all over the place at Royalton Radio and WFVR.org. Well, it's 11 o'clock on a Thursday. It is time for a Green Zine. And before we play a little music and then bring up my colleague Henry calling in from the Queen City, we do want to thank the folks that have kept Green Zine on the air for more than 11 years. One of our newer underwriters in the last year, the White River Land Collaborative based in Tunbridge. Also, Solarfest. I just got a note from Michael Bailey from Solarfest. They're up to some good things over there this year. They will launch their full festival, as they have done for many years, starting next summer in 2025. The First Branch Coffee Company is just committed to renewing their underwriting. Thank you very much, Lauren, and all the employees there at First Branch Coffee Company. The Upper Pass Beer Company, who have been renewing for a number of years. Daniel Leibowitz, Royal Trail Works, Bale, Building a Local Economy. Find out more about their work at balevt.org and the Tracking Solar Company down in Norwich, Vermont. Solaflect. We're going to be talking a little bit about flood and some legislation happening here in Vermont. And of course, we might not get into so much sea level rise, but here is a great bluegrass song that does touch on that subject. They've been at Jennybrook and the Jennybrook Bluegrass Festival coming up this summer, that last full weekend. Well, several days leading into the last full weekend in June at the Tunbridge Fairgrounds. Here's Mile 12 and City That Drowned.
City by the ocean. At night my father tells me so. Before the water took the earth back, before the plants refused to grow, its beauty never knew an equal. Its metal towers touched the sky, its people knew the warmth of sunlight, before the sunlight burned your eyes. And at night I dream about it, that my father's home I found. But I know it never can be, for no more is the city that drowned.
That one down in the mix. That is a great band originally out of Boston, and they have performed at Jennybrook in the past. They're called Mile 12 and City That Drowned. And I was watching a great film the other night called The Buena Vista Social Club, and Havana, Cuba is right on the ocean, right on the Atlantic. And that seawall that they have, it wasn't really even a storm happening. It was splashing up and over. I wonder if that's one of the global cities that's going to be threatened by sea level rise. Hey, good morning, Henry. I think we're well connected today. Are you there?
Yes, we're well connected. We have wealth. sound.
We do. We're still working on the antenna. Hey, I got an update. Patrick has one of those connectors, and he's going to hang it on his door. I'm going to pick that thing up. Who knows? Maybe before the snowstorm, I'll climb around on the roof again. But not with these northwest winds. Boy, the wind chill today is. How is it up there in Burlington?
It is fierce.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Forget about complaining about summer coming too early. Winter is back in a vengeance here today.
Yeah, it's kind of typical. March is a pretty tricky month here in the Green Mountain State, and it's proving its worth over the last several days, for sure.
Right. It is proving its worth. And we had, I don't know, how much snow did you get in the last day or 2 days? We've had snow flurries up here, and some of them have been noticeable.
Well, I think it depends, once again, on elevation. I saw a couple of folks who didn't clean their car off all the way, and it looked like they had 2 inches, and they were, I think, local folks. I think maybe up at your place, an inch and a half, just maybe a half inch at 900 feet in Tunbridge, more of a dusting. But up in the mountains, boy, the other day, let's see, over the weekend, 6 inches, when we were having like a drizzle, they had 6 inches. And then yesterday they picked up, probably by the end of the day, another 2 or 3 inches. And of course, Henry, you're being such a meteorologist, you're aware of a storm that is coming our way starting late tonight, I mean, tomorrow night into Saturday.
Yes. Weather is happening.
Weather is definitely happening.
So I have a grandson and granddaughter who are competition skiers in high school, but they're competition skiers, and they're trying to decide what to do. They had greatly curtailed ski season for themselves this year, and they're trying to figure out whether they have to move to Norway or somewhere to have ski to be able to do their training on for skiing. They had races canceled. They had practices where they should have gotten in 10 runs and got in 2 because the conditions were so crummy, and the had an article that I picked out for them from the Guardian newspaper, so it's carrying. It's talking about European ski areas, and it's saying when we reach 2°C, which some people say is going to happen quicker than you think.
Yeah.
Some people think it'll be a while longer, but nonetheless, when you get to 2°C, that a large percentage of the ski slopes in Europe will no longer be financially viable because of lack of snow and rain during the winter.
Yeah, and I'm guessing, I haven't been over there, but I'm guessing that in this country, the big corporate ski areas certainly investing heavily in artificial snowmaking, but I'm not aware that that's such a big project in Europe. So it's not like they're, no. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, I do. So the European slopes are above the tree line for the most part, and they ski over a lot of terrain, and they're not carved into the forest like our ski trails are. So ours lend themselves to having snowmaking on them,
yes,
and theirs do not, and there isn't nearly as much in. And yes, what we're doing at the ski areas here to be able to survive thaw periods during the winter and rain when you wanted snow is they are stockpiling lots of snow on the slopes so that they're still skiing after there's been some melt. And the snowmaking equipment has gotten very much more, better in the last 15 years, I would say.
Yes.
And so they're able to make snow Even above freezing, they can make it at 32 and a half degrees or something. And they're much more efficient in making it, but it's still an enormous amount of water and an enormous amount
of energy.
Energy to do it.
Yeah.
And the ski industry is trying to meet the Paris goals for climate change. And it's really a challenge for them. I mean, for them to generate enough electricity to do all the water pumping and air compressing that they do for making snow, much less running the lodges and lifts and all that. But mm-hmm. that snowmaking activity is a big energy sink, and making it on site will be a challenge for them.
Yeah, so this is bringing to mind several things, Henry, and you might want to have your pen ready, or I can email you later. So I'll start with that one. There is a nonprofit group that was formed probably 5 or 6 years ago, and they're called Protect Our Winters, POW, Protect
yes.
Our Winters.
Yes.
And I would bet that we can get someone to speak to us about some of these issues. First of all, what sort of things are they advising to the ski areas? Is there progress? What's their prognosis in the future? Like you say, if we get to 2 degrees centigrade, I think that could be an interesting conversation. To come back locally here, we're supposed to get quite a bit more snow over the weekend. And I can say, Henry, that yesterday on a couple of my runs, no artificial snow in the woods. There was enough powder in the higher elevation that Mother Nature came through, and for some reason one of my favorite trails had not been skied on. It's and maybe because it's kind of dangerous at the bottom, and my knee is telling me that today. But there were there were pockets of 10 to 12 inches of untouched powder there in the trees, and that all came down out of the sky, not out of a snow gun. So just to try to wrap up this thread with a little bit of a positive part on snow that
good
still
job.
is falling. Hey, I'm looking at a pretty good-looking owl. He can barely fit into that owl house, Henry. Boy, he must have wedged himself in there.
It's a mini owl.
It's a mini owl.
This is Bird Note, and we'll be listening to that, yes?
Yeah, and I'm going to go down here and make sure what happened last week doesn't happen. Yeah,
nest boxes on for
all sorts of birds. Yeah, we're going to go to that. We are on Bird Notes, 12 minutes into the hour of 11 o'clock here on Green Zine at Royalton Community Radio. Let's check out Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. You might be familiar with the classic bluebird nest box. In the 60s and 70s, people across North America installed bluebird boxes, and that helped reverse the decline of eastern bluebirds. A conservation success story. But there are many more species that need our help. Birds that historically nested in the cavities of dead trees are finding natural nest holes harder to come by. Many of these species will make use of a nest box in parks or near people's homes. Screech owls. Tiny, adorable owls will happily raise their little ones in a nest box designed for them. It's slightly bigger than a bluebird box, and it's best to install it a bit higher on a tree. Or you could build a house for wood ducks and mount it on a pole. If wood ducks do move in, be prepared for as many as 16 chicks to follow their mother out of the nest. Bird Note's on a mission to inspire 1 million people to take action to help birds over the next 3 years. For information on building all kinds of nest boxes and to learn more about what you can do to make a difference for birds, visit birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
I really like that, Henry, and particularly the sound of that screech owl. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure I've ever seen a screech owl.
Mm-hmm.
I think they are resident in Vermont. I suspect they're a woods creature for the most part. But
yeah, I think you're
many
right.
Owls are, I guess.
Yeah.
So we should just tell people that we are dealing with floods. We're going to talk about floods and how they happen, what's to be done about them, what you can do about it. And so we have Kevin Geiger from Two Rivers Ottauquechee, who specializes in thinking and organizing programs around what to do about flooding. And so he will be our guest shortly.
Yeah.
And
yeah, that'll be good.
Maybe
and
we want to go on and pick up that little piece that that Yale notes have about
under climate connections. Yeah, I see. Yeah, did you have a particular one that you wanted there, Henry?
Yeah, it's
I see one on wind farms.
Which actions benefit the climate the most?
Yes, I do see that one. So let's go to that, and then that's about a minute and a half long, and we'll be back with you. And then you don't have to quite get Kevin yet because it's not 20 after. Yeah.
No, I'm good.
Okay, here we go. Which actions benefit the climate the most? This tool can show you.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. Setting clean energy goals, pledging to plant billions of trees, mandating energy efficiency improvements. Lots of policies can reduce global warming, and it can be hard to know which are the most effective. So Climate Interactive and the MIT Sloan Sustainability Initiative created a free online simulation tool called En-ROADS.
To help people understand what policies are available and what kind of impact that they will have in terms of achieving desired climate goals.
Michael Overend, a volunteer with the nonprofit Citizens Climate Lobby, leads community workshops using En-ROADS. Users choose from a menu of climate policies, such as charging carbon polluters a fee or subsidizing EV purchases, and they can tweak variables like the amount charged on a ton of carbon. The tool provides instant feedback on how those policies would affect global temperature, sea level rise, and other outcomes if they were implemented worldwide.
It can be used to spark discussion among our leadership. It can be used to help educate community members
and inform action on the path toward a safer future. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Yeah, I'm glad you found that, Henry, that little snippet. Yep.
And I will put I will put a link up to that tool, so you can just click on that in our our little blue box, our links box, down at the bottom right hand side of the Royalton Radio website, and you can play with that tool. It's designed to be played with. All right, so that's that one. And then I wanted to just some more kind of positive thinking and news. 7 Days has an article talking about a group of 23 people.
Wealthy people.
Affluent.
Yes.
Affluent Vermonters that said, hey, let's pay our fair share. Let's accept a 3% surcharge tax and generate a fund that helps with climate. And so there's a link to that as well. It'll be on our website.
Yeah, and glad you're on top of that 7 Days, Henry. I think that just came out in this week's issue. So I think it just came out yesterday. You're on top of it.
I have an email link that takes me to all these good things. But you see things that I don't, because you read the newspaper in the real flesh.
Yeah, well, I do a little bit, but we do this together, and it's always been a great honor to work with you. Henry, this is a little bit of a humor, but these Yale Climate Connections, and I know you subscribe to another one of their newsletters. Are you an alumni of Yale?
No.
That's the humor part, right? No. But yes. You're well connected there, though.
I know people who are. So I have one more thing, and then I'll go and get a guest.
Okay, that'd be fine.
Also, we'll put a link for this up in the chat. There is a building that is actually constructed in Taipei, Taiwan, and it is a building that has been twisted so that as you go up, it has its little outdoor decks revolving 90 degrees around the building as it goes up. And it's an apartment building, and it's all loaded up with plants and trees so that it will actually absorb carbon.
Wow.
And it also has the roof covered with solar panels to give it some energy. So it's an attempt to be a building that is sucking up more carbon than it puts out. And I thought that was – it's quite a pretty building. So there's a link to that. You can see that as well on that link.
All right. I'll look forward to
checking
that out.
So I will go and get
Kevin Geiger.
Kevin
yep.
Geiger, yes.
All right. And I'll carry on. We'll be back with Henry in just a couple minutes. You're listening to Green Zine, and I'm going to turn this up. I think you can hear the southbound Vermonter coming in, certainly a less carbon-intensive way to travel. Right now, let's bring up a little bit music from a interesting jazz group that I learned of from Chris Perry, one of the founders of the Upper Pass Beer Company, an underwriter of this radio station. This band is called Snarky Puppy, and a piece called Flood. And we'll be talking about floods in just a couple moments with Two Rivers Ottauquechee Regional Planning Commission guy, Kevin Geiger. I'm going to give you a little bit more information here on Green Zine. That's primarily what we're here for, is one of the educational components of this nonprofit, all-volunteer radio station. You want to get directly involved? Here's a good way to do it. This program is moving into its second or third year. This is in today's White River Valley Herald, page B9. Yeah, very benign, not malignant. Applications now open for VCRD's Climate Catalyst Leadership Program, and that stands for the Vermont Council on Rural Development. They are seeking applicants for their fifth Climate Catalyst Leadership Program. Over the past 4 years, the group has worked to implement projects such as building a countywide farmer climate network, establishing community-wide weatherization efforts, facilitating the development of community solar projects, starting a town energy and climate committee, and more. The Climate Catalyst Leadership Program. Participants arrive with or develop transformative community-scale climate economy-related projects and work toward developing their concepts into reality while building peer connections, strengthening leadership skills, and receiving project development support. VCRD strives to support locally generated ideas and projects and the outstanding local leaders who champion them. I can think of a few people who should apply, who live right around here. This program provides the opportunity for people at various stages of life to come together across the state and across networks. State's program manager, Laura Cavan Bailey, each participant works through their own place-based project, while also engaging in rich dialogue around the larger state and global implications of the climate disruptions. New this year, interested participants may also choose to focus on a group project to be determined at the first session, or may be paired with flood-impacted or flood-susceptible communities, for instance, Woodstock and Bridgewater and Rochester, etc. Applications are now open for this fifth cohort, and the Climate Catalyst will begin in May. And to learn more, well, we'll get this posted at our website as well. I can tell you this, though, the deadline's not that far away, 5 p.m. on April the 15th. Well, I think we probably have given some time to Henry to get together with Kevin Geiger, so I'm going to bring down Snarky Puppy. We may return to that piece towards the end of the show. Henry, are you back with us?
I am, and I have Kevin Geiger of Two Rivers Out of Queechy on the phone, and we're going to find out a little bit about Two Rivers and how he got into the role he did, trying to manage our flood zone, which climate isn't making any easier to do. So welcome to Green Scene, Kevin.
Good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Kevin. Morning. Good to have you on with us.
Great. So I can just begin, if that's okay, and talk
Absolutely.
A little bit about kind of who I am and what we are, and then get into talking about floods and rivers a little bit. So I am the chief planner at the Two Rivers Out of Queechy Regional Commission, which is the regional planning commission that covers all of your listening area. We go from Newbury on the Connecticut River down to Heartland, and then westward over to Plymouth and all the way up to Granville. And I got into this just because flood and land use planning are part of the profession. And in particular, I've done a lot of work with emergency management over the years. And then following Tropical Storm Irene, I was integral in the state's buyout program. So I dealt with a lot of people whose houses were no longer livable at that point. And, you know, when you do that for a while, you kind of wish you didn't. And, you know, so you're trying to always help communities avoid foreseeable problems, which is the essence of planning. You know, we can see what's coming ahead, and we can try to get out of the way. So if it's okay, I'll talk a little bit about kind of rivers and river dynamics and flooding.
Yes, yes. How come we get floods?
Because it rains a lot, and it's going to rain more. All of the indications are that sometime around 1996, what we call the precipitation regime, how much it rains, actually has changed. And that's not total rain from beginning to the end of the year. That's more that it's coming down fast in buckets in shorter amounts of time. And that really affects how that floods happen, especially flash floods. Not so much the bigger rivers, though. The White responds slowly to those events, but all the smaller streams respond much more quickly. And I do want to stress that if you can hear water from your house, you're close to a river. And even if it's a very small stream, with the right watershed above it and the right rainstorm coming down, that can be pretty dramatic. And I've seen streams you can literally step across move entire trees down them during floods, and you know, boulders you can't lift up. So be aware of that. And everybody can get flood insurance, no matter where you are and no matter that you're not in a flood zone. You can get flood insurance, and it's a lot cheaper. And your homeowner's insurance does not cover flood damage. I do want to stress that. Because some people think you can't get it just because you're not in a mapped flood zone. And while I'm on maps, a little bit about maps. Our maps were made pretty much in the late 70s and early 80s based upon stereoscopic aerial photography that showed us the lay of the land. And looking backwards at our flood history. So our flood history has changed since then, but the maps haven't changed, and our topographic information has changed, but the maps haven't changed. And so I like to say our maps are basically disco era. And so if you've still got the clothes from the disco era, that's about as good as the maps are as well. We're going to be getting new maps, but they will not show all of the flood danger out there. And they won't be showing the future flood damage so much as the past flood damage, and that's important for people.
And Kevin, why is that? Why are they not able to get into that much detail with these revised maps?
Somewhat, they're not required by law to, and And the other thing is they don't have an agreed upon what will be coming for floods. So we do know that basically the extreme events are getting increasing. And the other reason also is that flash flooding is not really done very well within the FEMA scope of flood maps. So that is what it is there.
Yeah.
Better than nothing.
it's better than nothing, and they are often quite accurate in some places. The other thing that we have in Vermont, and it's available online, is what we call river corridors. And because FEMA is concerned that the water is going to come up and inundate you, not so much that the water is fast and it's going to erode. And the river corridor maps are more about the erosion and the force of the water, and that the river might move sideways during a flood event. And I, for those of you who've dealt with any type of kind of, when I was a little kid, we had these things that were basically like a little plastic hose. I forget what it was called. But you turn it on and it would wiggle all over and spray water, and it was good on a summer day. But this the same issue if you have ever held a fire hose that's pressurized with water. That is going to try to move sideways. It's interesting. You'd think it might just try to stick out straight because it's under pressure. But no, it actually tries to wiggle. And our rivers and streams do the same thing. And so they are going to do that. And certainly up in Rochester and in other places, we saw that. We don't see it so much further down the stream. But we have places in Randolph, for example, where the river has moved so far sideways since they made the flood maps that the river is no longer inside the mapped flood area.
So you were saying that the river corridors, that the way we have straightened them out and got them so they didn't take our roads out, put erosion control on the side and so forth, that's made the water run faster, which then makes it want to move sideways, and that's why it will take out a bank on one side or the other. It's that garden hose wanting to jet around and form a slow moving riverbed instead of a channelized one.
Right. The rivers don't really want to move fast. They want to move slower. They're like you and me, I say. they want to eat sediment. That's their food. And then they want to lie down on their couch, which is the floodplain, and have a break. And when we deny them sediment and we constrain them, it makes them ornery. And they're going to go someplace else and get that food. And that's one of the reasons why dredging, which used to be a historic practice where we would go and scoop out riverbeds because it was handy gravel, and it was kind of a way of cleaning the pipe, if you think about streams like drains, which they are not. But what we found out is when we do that and remove that sediment from a riverbed, the river goes, oh my God, what happened to my sediment? I got to go get some more, and it goes back up the valleys and paws out that sediment again from banks and puts it back. And so if you think about removing sediment from a stream bed, essentially you might as well just go dig it out of somebody's bank up the valley, because that's what's going to happen in terms of getting that sediment back into there. And our streams are very straightened. Our streams, especially our major rivers, are no longer in a natural shape. We think of them because they may have been there a long while, but they were largely put there by bulldozers and whatnot over the years. And so they're still in the process of trying to move. And every time we've held them in place because of a road or a house, like I have in my house, put big rocks there, it's going to try to wiggle somewhere else. And so it's important for us to be giving the rivers those opportunities out there to wiggle as much as they can.
Hmm. So how do we do that? What actions, if you were a landowner down to a bank of a river, what's best practice?
Best practice is to stay away from it in terms of, you know, building things and let the river do its stuff. After all, we are kind of in its living room. It was here before us. And then if you have an eroding bank, there are things you can do about trying to stabilize that bank without just using rocks. Try not to think about putting the river back. If the river moves sideways, some people, well, I want to push it back to where it was. And that's pretty much not going to be a good idea. It's going to want to come sideways. But you might do things like, just in the upcoming months, for example, red osier dogwoods, as well as willows and some other species, you can just cut them into, like, sticks, basically, and jam them down in that wet bank, and they will largely grow. And that'll help stabilize things a little more naturally and give the plants and the animals some benefit out there. Other places you may have to use rock, and anybody working on the banks of a stream has to get a state permit if they're going to be putting rocks and whatnot down there. And so you talk to this, what we call a state stream alteration engineer. If, you know, your house is at risk or something is really at risk, that's not just dirt at risk. The other than that, you know, enjoy the water, because it's nice that it's there. And remember that our floodplains, our fertile floodplains where we love to farm, that was because of flooding. Flooding gives us floodplains and farmland, and we should not be afraid of that. That's how we got all that stuff out there.
Yeah, you know, I was just the other day thinking of the red osier dogwood. We have a brook that runs pretty close. We're up the in the hills a bit, and it's far enough away, and we definitely hear it year round. Although two summers ago during the drought, there was hardly anything in there. But we were down on the lower part of the property where this brook makes a turn, and I did, you know, I live with a plant expert, so I learned a little bit from her. The amount of red osier dogwood along there, right there on the floodplain and along the brook, and I could see an area that had flooded slightly, but it wasn't really major, and I didn't see much erosion in that area. So that's good to know that there are proactive things that people can do that are not really disturbing, like you say, where you need a permit to put rocks in there. So there are things that people can kind of have a hands-on approach to.
Right. All of that, the vegetation along streams, and the rough rule of thumb is you want at least 35 feet from the top of bank. And that holds stuff. That also helps filter. It's like a big coffee filter of sorts. And so if you have nutrients and sediment that is running off the landscape towards the river, that undisturbed leafy area really sucks up that nitrogen, especially nitrogen and phosphorus, as well as sediment, and keeps it out of the stream versus having a lawn down to the stream, which, of course, now in Vermont, if you're a lakeshore owner, you can't do. Nobody gets to make a lawn down to the stream because that's not a good idea.
So talk, just pick up on that nitrogen thing. Oh, why do we care about nitrogen getting into the stream? And I guess for our watershed, that is our biggest pollutant factor, whereas the other side of the Green Mountains, the drainage towards Lake Champlain, it's phosphorus going into lake that is the biggest problem.
Correct.
Can you comment about the nitrogen and where it goes and what it does and why we want to keep it on the land?
Yeah, in both cases, both the phosphorus for Lake Champlain and the nitrogen for the Connecticut River watershed, they're exactly like putting nitrogen and phosphorus on your garden. They're fertilizers, and they make things grow, and in particular, they make algae grow. And so you don't want that in the streams because it's going to clog things up. It's going to reduce the oxygen level. It's going to cloud the waters. It's going to make potentially mats. And if you were up in the Lake Champlain area, I mean, it can even make things like pea soupy out there. Where we get nitrogen is just from straight dirt, you know, which has a decent amount of nitrogen in it, but from any runoff as well, from our septic tanks, but from roads, from farm fields, and you name it. And so, again, the best thing that absorbs that is carbon, which you can think of as leaves, dead leaves. And that nitrogen then binds to that carbon and makes the plants happy that are there in the bank, instead of getting into the rivers where we really don't want it. And sediment itself, I mean, there's going to be a certain amount of sediment in streams, but just straight old dirt going into the stream can clog up fish habitat, especially where they're trying to lay their eggs and other critters in the stream. And so we don't want too much of that out there either. If farmers, farmers are losing fields, there is programs through the USDA to help try to stabilize those banks, because there's no point just sending that dirt downstream. But also what we try not to do is try not to have people just put rocks there as well, because unless you're using very, very big rocks, number one, they're probably just going to go down the stream too. And it's, again, it's squeezing the snake, or holding the snake. If you think about, like, if you try to hold a snake, the rest of it's going to wiggle. And that's what rocks do, is it holds the snake in one spot. And so the rest of the stream is going to try to move around. But back to those river corridor maps, I was saying that we do have those. The entire state has them, and so people can see them online. And that's the area that is estimated that the river is going to want to move sideways in, back and forth. And so that's a good idea if you see that, to kind of go, oh, even though maybe FEMA says I'm fine here, and even though I'm a decent ways from the water, maybe the stream is going to want to come over here. And in certain parts of our region, especially the upper White, as you're more in Braintree or in Stockbridge and Pittsfield somewhat, you can really see the river trying to go sideways.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay.
Hey, so I've got a question here that Kevin can probably illuminate for us. So I'm noticing we get, Henry and I, and I'm sure you do as well, get all kinds of notices on a daily, if not weekly, basis from nonprofits doing work up in Montpelier. And this one's from the Vermont Natural Resource Council, and it's saying that yesterday the Vermont Senate advanced the Flood Safety Act by a pretty substantial margin. It says it's there to protect river corridors, wetlands, and improve dam safety. Do you know some of the components that are in that act that you think are a good idea, or whether it's robust enough? Are you familiar with Senate Bill 213, Kevin?
I am familiar with it somewhat. I think that there are several good things in there, and then there are things that are good intentions that I would do differently.
Okay.
But I think one of the big things is that we need to recognize that we can't keep losing wetlands. Wetlands are sponges, and besides being good habitat in their own right, if we just think about them as, you know, serving our needs, they hold a lot of water. And so you want that rainstorm much more to go into that sponge than to just plunge downstream. So I think we need to get more serious about holding the wetlands that we do have, instead of just kind of fighting a slightly losing war on that. The other thing that we do need is we do need better maps. I think they're a bit ambitious in the bill about how they're going to do that, but we don't have very good maps for all the smaller wetlands. And so it's hard for somebody who's not, you know, a wetland biologist or whatever, to necessarily know, well, wait a minute, I shouldn't be here because this is a mapped wetland, because a lot of wetlands don't show up on those maps. That's one thing. I do think that the state could enact more stringent base regulations on floodplains. Floodplains are regulated largely all at the local level Vermont, and so towns are free to kind of choose the base FEMA model, which is pretty poor, or do some additions on there. And by state law, we could just say, no, you can't do things like fill in the floodplain. The FEMA model assumes that you're going to fill in the floodplain, because they're all about getting high enough. And again, you know, children can tell you if you fill in the floodplain, the water's going to go somewhere else. So let's stop doing that. And let's give ourselves an extra foot. So if FEMA says the water's going to be, you know, up to a certain spot, build a foot higher just to give yourself a little bit. I kind of think about, you know, if you're in a canoe, do you want your gunwale at the surface of the water, or would you rather have some space between the edge of your canoe and the top of the water? So we should have 1 foot of what we call freeboard there as an example. And so basically things like that should definitely get done just across the state.
With climate change, do you think a foot is enough? It seems to me maybe 5 feet would be more appropriate.
Yeah, well, for what we call critical facilities, we suggest 2 feet, which often, in a floodplain, that 2 feet's a lot of water as it spreads out.
Yeah.
And that's often relates to what we think of as the 500-year flood zone. Since I said 500-year, I do want to kind of talk about what we call the 100-year. People think the 100-year flood is only going to happen every 100 years. And statistically, over eons, yes, that's true. But what it actually means is that it's a 1% chance every year. So each year you roll the dice that's got, you know, 1 in 100 chance of that flood happening. However, that's the old flood. We are now more in a place where we should expect an Irene or a flood of last year's size, you know, every 15, 20 years or so on average, which doesn't mean you won't get it, you know, year after
2 years in a row.
Right. And we have had so-called 1,000-year floods and 500-year floods. We've had 3 presidentially declared flood disasters since July. And some of our towns, Bethel included, had a damaging flood on July 7th before the flood on July 9th and 10th hit. Bridgewater got slammed on July 4th, and then on the 7th, and then on the 9th, all with enormous rainstorms. So it's these things are happening more and more and more, and people need to take that into account. I just say believe in the flood. Don't
yeah.
think like, ah, that's not going to happen. No, believe in it.
We definitely
with our
do.
Steep hillsides, when we get a big rain dump, when we get a storm that really pours down rain, it runs off the landscape, at least our current landscape, and it makes the water rise. It's just amazing. I mean, I'm still shocked by the amount that the White River came up during Irene. There was a farmer who had a story in a newspaper over at the Royalton Bethel entrance to the interstate. There's a piece of farmland there. And the farmer was out on that land with his tractor, with his with a young child, and it was starting to rain hard, and he thought, well, I better head back to the house. And he headed back to the house, and he said the water came all the way up to his axle before he got to the house.
Close call.
Yes,
there.
Yeah, it's when it's I know many people during Irene that, you know, the fire department knocked on their door, and by the time they grabbed a few things and stepped out, they were stepping in the water. And we were very, very lucky in Irene. I think that because Irene was a Sunday afternoon, and during the daylight, and people were home, and especially our volunteer firefighters who do such a great job, they're busy, And if things happen on a weekend when they're home and during the daylight, they're available to run around. But if you were caught, you know, in the night in one of these things and didn't really know that that water was rising like that, it could get nasty fast. That is why we say, you know, floods aren't surprises. The National Weather Service issues flood warnings and watches, and if they're issuing a flood warning, that means it's time to be very, very aware and never drive through water. People drive through little streams thinking they're little streams, and that culvert may not be there anymore. And we have had at least one death, I remember, where somebody drove what they thought was just the road was a little flooded, and the road was not there at all. Lost their life.
Yeah, real cautionary tale. Hey, as we get towards the end here, I just want to remind folks that being a community radio station and having an emergency alert system, and in fact, the last flood that was impacting Bridgewater and Woodstock area, we were getting those reports and being able to put them out on the air automatically. So, and the station got started about a year after Irene, and that was not actually a reason why we wanted to get the station up. But there are ways of communicating and making sure that people are aware of that. And Kevin, really appreciate all your updated information and look forward to seeing the new maps when they come out, and keep up the good work down there at Two Rivers.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Been educational.
All righty. And hopefully we will stay dry for a little bit here.
A little bit, yeah.
Yes, a little bit. We don't want to be too dry.
Once the snow melts.
One or the other. Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
All right, Henry, we've got about 9 minutes left in the show, and since I'm on the VNRC email that came to me, here's something that I've heard about in the past, but I didn't know it was coming close to us. And actually, tonight there's a set of environmental films that's being shown. Actually, that was last night, so we missed out on that. But VNRC is now announcing the annual Wild and Scenic Film Festival. It's happening in two places, one up near where you are right now, Henry, in Burlington, on April 18th, but earlier than that, only a couple weeks away, on April 4th in Woodstock at the Town Hall Theater. And it looks like it's a ticketed event. The best thing that you can do is go to vnrc.org. If you're free that evening, I think it's going to be a fascinating group of films, and I think I can make myself free for that evening. I got some more things, Henry, but I'm going to toss it back to you.
So I have another upcoming event. Bill McKibben is part of a speaker series, and so that's going to be on March 26th. So we're the 21st now. I think that must put it out. There we are, Tuesday. And it's at 8 o'clock in the evening, and I'll put a link for that up. But that's something that you can participate online for. So you need to ask for a link. You have to go follow my posts that I'll put up on our link board, and he's talking about in the hottest year, where do we stand? Notes from the climate fight. So that's and there will be obviously a chance to interact in that visiting with Bill McKibben.
And here's another film, actually, the following night, and this one is virtual. So this is being put together by Sustainable Woodstock, along with the Pentangle Arts and the Vermont Humanities Council. And it's going to feature the director of a film that's called Inundation District. The filmmaker is David Abel, and it's all happening at 6:30 p.m. virtually on April the 5th. It says here, celebrate Earth Day with Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and documentary filmmaker David Abel, director of Inundation District. He is a, this movie is about how Boston decided to try to combat climate change and rising sea waters by building a large sort of, Anyway, it's all about that. And if you're interested in seeing it, I would just go to Sustainable Woodstock. The link will be there. It's kind of an early celebration of Earth Day because all of us know that Earth Day happens, I'm pretty sure it's right around either April 20th or April 22nd. And we'll give you more details on other activities that are happening at that point.
Yes. So you had just told about the April 5th, the inundation.
Yes. I'm bringing the flood back up here.
I'm trying to make a link on the website.
Oh, okay. Wow. We're working hard. Hey, I got, there's some bills, and I'm not going to name them, but there's an update on bills at the Vermont legislature that have made the crossover, and a few of them are dealing with the environment. And you can find this list of bills on page B4 of today's Herald, the March 21st edition. One that I will point out that is making some traction, and it probably will end up on the governor's desk, is Senate Bill 5, the Clean Heat Standard, meant to reduce Vermont's greenhouse gas emissions from the thermal sector, will be going there. And here's something that I didn't know. Another Senate bill makes multiple changes related to the authority of Vermont's PUC, including authority to host remote meetings and authorize parties to waive statutory deadlines. But this also creates the Legislative Working Group on Renewable Energy Standard Reform. So another little group being created. These bills have not been fully passed yet, but they are making their way towards the government, towards the governor's desk.
Okay. Let's do that. All right.
A little bit on EVs, Henry. So, I've got it right here in front of me with 4 minutes to go. A story released, today, actually, by the New York Times. Biden administration yesterday issued one of the most significant climate regulations in the nation's history, a rule designed to ensure that the majority of new passenger cars and light trucks sold in this country are all electric or hybrids by 2032. So that's in the next 8 years. It's coming, Henry. Nearly 3 years in the making.
Yeah, and they've kind of backed off on pure EVs.
The auto manufacturers pushed back pretty hard on that. Yep.
And that's partly because I don't think they felt they could get enough battery material to do 100% EVs and a hybrid vehicle
much smaller battery. Yeah, much smaller battery.
20 or 30 miles, smaller battery. But my daughter has one of those, and she says most of the time she never puts gas in it. She's just driving on electric. It's only when they head off somewhere that they land up putting gas.
Right. So in the end, you know, a half a loaf is better than no loaf. And it is kind of a compromise with the auto manufacturers and the fossil fuel industry. My partner was pointing out a column that mentioned how many gas stations there are in the country right now and then how many charging stations there are. And it's about a 10-to-1 ratio gas stations to EVs. People are still pretty nervous. But if they their driving habits led them towards a hybrid, either because of driving locally or because of cost factors, and like your daughter is really using the smaller battery, then in the end it's still a big step forward.
Yes. And so one of the things that the Vermont 350 electricity working group has been working on is to we're trying to make the grid better, but because we are moving towards more and more electric driving and heating and cooling in our house, and that's demanding more electricity, and that seems to be shaping up pretty well. And we said, well, what are the really big problems? And the really big problem is that there's very little, or there's only modest amount of support for renewable energy, and there's a great deal of government money, federal government money, going into the oil, the fossil fuel industry, to enable them to have more fossil fuel. And so a group of us are actually going to meet with our representatives and are going to talk to them about how to reduce that money that's going to the fossil fuel industry.
Okay,
So we're not shoring them up.
Let me know how that meeting works out, Henry.
We'll have to report back on that. I suspect it's a difficult boulder to roll.
It is indeed. Hey, we're just wrapping up the show here at Royalton Community Radio. You've been listening to Green Zine. We'll be back next Thursday at 11, and the show is available at our replay function by going to WFVR.org. If you found it interesting, you want to tell a friend about it, they can easily find us at our website. Green Zine is brought to you today by Solaflect, Bale, Royal Trailworks, Daniel Leibowitz, the Upper Pass Beer Company, First Branch Coffee Company, Solar Fest, and the White River Land Collaborative. Henry, always good to hang with you. I look forward to talking with you next week.
Excellent. I'll be looking forward for that link you said you were going to send me about.
Will do.
Show.